Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. An exhibit titled A Few Good Women, Advancing the Cause of Women in Government, 1969 to 74, is on display now through April 17th in the main exhibit hall of Penn State's Petit Library. The special collection of oral histories details a little-remembered initiative by the Nixon administration to recruit and advance women into higher-level government positions. Many of the women involved are now nearing retirement. Some have retired, and a few have passed away. As a result, preserving their memories and recollections has become even more important. Let's take note with the Honorable Barbara Franklin. She's President and Chief Executive Officer of Barbara Franklin Enterprises and former U.S. Secretary of Commerce. She's also one of the driving forces behind both the original initiative and now preservation of the historical record. Barbara Franklin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I love coming back to Penn State, always.
Speaking of Penn State, that's part of your history. You were born in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and graduated with distinction from Penn State University, then went on to the Harvard Business School. And in fact, you were actually one of the first women to graduate from Harvard.
Yes, that's right. Long time ago. Yes, I'm proud of that. We all of us, there were a dozen of us in a class of about 680 men, and we all managed to get through and survive to this day. We have a reunion coming up in the fall, and it's one of the few times that those few of us who were the pioneers in that class get together. So I'm looking forward to that.
After graduation, you worked in the business world. You served as environmental analyst for the Singer Company, and then as an assistant vice president for Citibank. But a question that was posed to a newly elected President Nixon by a newspaper journalist by the name of Vera Glasser changed all of that. Tell us a little bit about that and about this oral history project that you've been involved in for the last 13 years.
Well, we're delighted to be back to see the exhibit and have a presentation to make about the whole thing. Well, you know, as time went on, I was in the Nixon White House between 1971 and 73 when this initiative to advance women took place. But as time went on, I began to see, and so did some others who were there, how important that chapter really was in terms of the march of history into higher leadership and policymaking positions in our government. Someday we aim for a woman to be elected president. Well, we didn't know quite how to document that chapter, and it's overwhelmed anyway by Watergate and by the opening to China. And Lee Stout, who'd been the university archivist at the time, had my papers. This was after I was out of the Commerce Secretary job. He looked at all of this White House stuff, and he said, you know, this was real. This wasn't just puff. And how about an oral history project to document it? And that's how we began. I raised the money to support the project. We gathered a small group who were there at the time in the 70s to be an advisory board. And we went under the consultation and help of Penn State Libraries, Lee Stout. And then when Nancy Eaton, now Dean of Libraries, came, she was enormously helpful in getting all of this going and continuing. And we now are about to wrap up the interviews with 50 at least. We'll probably have a couple more than that. And now we're heading toward a coffee table type book that would document all of this and 6 through 12 teaching aids so that young people who might be in a civics or history class where these aids could be used might know just what kind of pioneering went on back then that helped to open the doors and pave the way for women today.
It gives us an idea of who we owed a debt of gratitude to, and it begins with this reporter that I mentioned.
Yes.
By the name of Vera Glasser. Give us a little background on Vera before we play one of the first clips, and this is a clip that is part of the exhibition and part of the permanent collection here at Penn State.
Oh, very good. Well, I knew Vera, of course, and I have to describe Vera as quite an attractive woman and very well-spoken. So I can imagine when she got up and asked this question in the White House briefing room that there must have been an audible kind of a sigh, like, oh my goodness, because it was quite a direct question, and I'm sure she delivered it very well, and that's what started a train of events, and President Nixon really picked it up from there.
Let's have a listen.
When he recognized me, I had to make a snap judgment what I was going to ask him, and I decided that it would be the one about women, and it went pretty much like this. We can check the record. Mr. President, since you've been inaugurated, you have made approximately 200 presidential appointments, and only three of them have gone to women. Can we expect some more equitable recognition of women's activities, or are we going to remain the lost sex? Well, you know, there were some chuckles, because earlier than that, the famous journalist May Craig, who would question the president, would put on a pretty tough demeanor, and a lot of the men would laugh at her, and so there were some giggles at this. Because it was, quote-unquote, a woman's question. Well, the president kind of smiled at first, and he leaned back and he said, would you care to come into the administration? Which I thought was, frankly, a little bit snide at that point. But there you know, there was a lot of bustle and excitement in the room. And he must have then realized, well, you know, I'm on television with 50 million people watching. And he became quite serious, and he said that, well, you know, I really hadn't been aware of that, and that we will do something as soon as possible.
As a result of that question, President Nixon actually created the Task Force on Women's Rights and Responsibilities. And we should mention that up until this time, only two women had ever been appointed to cabinet positions. Tell us, what was your role in the Nixon administration?
Well, out of that task force on women's rights and responsibilities came really a bunch of quite forward-looking recommendations. One of them was that the president ought to appoint more women to policymaking jobs and equalize the ratio of men to women in our federal government. Another recommendation was that he should create a White House office and have somebody in charge of that effort. And that's what my job was. I was recruited from Citibank in New York to come in, start a recruiting process for women appointees. And then I was also to monitor the action plans that the president asked each cabinet secretary and agency head for, action plans about how they were going to train, advance, hire women in their departments. So that was my job. I was the recruiter. I was to build a talent bank of women, and I was to monitor the progress toward these action plans.
President Nixon wasn't just talk.
No, the fact that he, and when any president does this, it's quite serious, that he required by memorandum to these cabinet secretaries and agency heads, required an action plan and said, get it back to me by the middle of May. This was in April. That becomes serious. Then people take notice and they try to deliver. I have to tell you, when those action plans came back, they were really kind of a mess. They had obviously been put together by people who'd never done this before, because no one had ever done this before. And so we had to go back to those departments and agencies and ask for some revisions and some help here and there, and there were targets that they were to meet. But the bottom line was that it was a managerial effort, and that's what really made it work.
A number of people who helped you in your effort along the way was Rita Hauser. She was one of the first women graduates of Harvard Law School, and she was appointed to the UN Commission for Human Rights as a mm-hmm. result of her work in Richard Nixon's election campaign, and we're going to hear a clip from her. Give us a little bit of background on Rita Hauser.
Well, Rita is a very astute, brilliant woman, and she had gotten to know then the Attorney General, who was appointed by Nixon, John Mitchell, through the campaign, and he wanted to have her come into government. So did the president. She didn't want to leave New York. She had two young children and a husband, and so that's why she went to the UN, which is in New York. Rita was what would be called a feminist, maybe, except that term was a bad word back in those days. And the women's movement, which had picked up steam in the 1960s, had become a kind of a left-wing bra-burning movement. And Rita was the other side of that. She was the more moderate conservative feminist.
Let's have a listen.
There was a picture of me on the front page of the Washington Post one morning with a big headline saying, call for women in the campaign and women in government, you know, and they played it up as something very radical. I to this day don't know how that story got to them, but somebody obviously leaked the memo. And you see the sensitivity when I had to say responsible feminism, because if you just said feminism, the picture that was evoked was the Bella Abzug standing on the street corners. It was a time of bra burning and all of that. So we, you know, we want to make very clear that that was not what we had in mind.
How important, in your opinion, is it that that these oral histories be captured, and how challenging is it to actually get them, to track down these women and record their stories?
Well, we had to start with lists that were in my White House papers, and I knew where some of these women were, but really the majority, I think we didn't. We really had no addresses, so we had to go find them. And so that's what we set out to do, and then we set up an interview schedule, and Jean Rainey, who was the first administrator of this project, a woman who had her PR firm earlier in Washington, but knew many of these women during that era. She was the interviewer initially, and did quite a handsome job of traveling around the country once we found these folks. But it was important to capture them while we could. And so we started with the ones we knew were older. And I'm glad we did, because we have lost some along the way, and I'm very pleased that we have people like Catherine Bedell and Anne Armstrong who are now gone. But it was a bit of it took a bit of effort.
Can you quantify for us what difference all of this has made? So many women have made it through the glass ceiling, and including some of the accomplishments you've made in your own career. In 1972, there were just 36 women employed in government. What's the situation today, and to what extent can you attribute it to some of this early pioneering work?
Well, you know, we set a goal when we first started out to double the number of women in policymaking jobs within a year. Well, that was done in 9 months, and really a year later, the number had tripled from 36 to 105, which sounds like not very many, but at the time, that was a rather big accomplishment. Today, we have gotten to the stage where we don't even count anymore. There are just so many women in key positions, really everywhere. And so we've made a lot of progress. I think this chapter in the 70s is part of the advance of women in leadership positions. And that's what was really important about it. And that's why it's women's history of a significant sort.
Barbara Franklin is former U.S. Secretary of Commerce and one of the driving forces behind efforts to advance the cause of women in government. The Special Collection Library at Penn State was chosen to house these special recordings. You can access them online. You'll find a link to the Few Good Women website from our website, wpsu.org. There's also a special exhibit titled A Few Good Women, Advancing the Cause of Women in Government, 1969 to 74, on display now through April 17th in the main exhibit hall of Petit Library. Barbara Franklin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. The Humane Society of the United States says Pennsylvania is one of several states where lucrative, largely unregulated puppy mills are located. Will a new state law help the state shed its reputation as the puppy mill capital of the East? Let's take note with Sarah Speed. She's a lawyer and Pennsylvania State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. She's based in Harrisburg. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Pennsylvania has a reputation as the puppy mill capital of the East. Is the reputation warranted?
I believe so. Up until the passage of this new law, which was termed the dog law overhaul, also House Bill 2525, Pennsylvania had very low standards that were almost unenforceable for the dog law wardens. So breeders were able to get away with some pretty abusive practices, for example, keeping dogs in cages their entire lives, supplying them with only wire flooring, or power washing cages down with the dogs still inside, which all really contributed to that evil reputation.
Well, many of us are familiar with the Animal Welfare Act. It passed Congress in 1966. Wasn't that federal law
enough to prevent the kinds of things you just mentioned?
No, it wasn't. The Animal Welfare Act sets basic standards for basically transportation of animals. And although the USDA does license some large-scale commercial breeders, there are some pretty serious loopholes to the USDA law, leaving a large area for the state to regulate. So any breeding facility that did not sell enough dogs or sold dogs directly to the public was not covered under USDA standards, which, again, federal standards are meant to be a floor. So state standards are supposed to be a bit better, and now under 2525, they are.
This new act passed in October. Governor Rendell has been pushing this kind of legislation for quite some time, was successful recently. What was the impetus? Why was he so supportive of your efforts?
Well, Governor Rendell adopted a dog named Maggie. I believe she's a golden retriever, and she is a puppy mill survivor. She was bred to be a puppy mill mom, and after one litter, medical complications meant she could no longer breed. So she was allowed to be adopted out. And so going through that hardship with Maggie and understanding what she went through and what so many others like her go through every day in Pennsylvania was really the pushing point behind this legislation.
Well, the fact that she was adopted out sounds like good news.
It was. It doesn't always happen. Like we saw in Kutztown, it was completely legal under prior law for commercial breeders to kill any dogs. They could bury them. They could drown them, shoot them, get rid of them in any way they wanted. Some breeders do have relationships with rescues and will give over the dogs that they no longer want, and we certainly encourage them to do so.
In fact, when the situation in Pennsylvania came to light and more Pennsylvanians heard about it, some of them because of billboards and Oprah Winfrey's efforts behind this whole thing, there were two eastern Pennsylvania kennels that shot 80 dogs after they were ordered to let veterinarians examine some of them. How common are situations like that?
It's very common. Under our new law, that is no longer allowed. That's part of the reason Governor Rendell signed the bill the evening that it passed on concurrence in the state house. The reason for that is that under this current law, no commercial breeding facility may euthanize their own animals. They have to be taken to a veterinarian. And also, there's a double layer of protection. Any animal under an order from a dog law warden or Humane Society police officer for a veterinary check or other medical issues cannot be euthanized without prior approval of the Department of Agriculture. So we've got it covered from both ends.
Now, Ken Brandt, he's a lobbyist for the Pennsylvania Professional Dog Breeders Association, and he represents some 400 breeders in the state. He says quality breeders got shortchanged by the ones who have not been operating properly, and he thinks this law, this new law, goes too far. How do you respond to that?
I respond by saying we've come up with a very limited definition of a commercial kennel, and that is any kennel that transfers or sells more than 65 dogs per year or sells or transfers dogs wholesale or directly to a pet store. So that's only that particular class of kennel that has to comply with the bulk of these standards, which are, you know, larger cage spaces, no longer allowing the dogs to stand on wire floor, allowing them access to the outdoors. And good breeders are already doing those practices. Good breeders have their dogs with access to the outdoors. They're getting them veterinary care. Any other kind of breeding facility, and that's sportsman, hobby, any small breeding kennels, all they have to do is come up with an exercise plan that's approved by a veterinarian and install smoke alarms. This is not at all unduly burdensome.
There are 2,600 licensed kennels in Pennsylvania. Give us an idea of the scope of the problem. How many of them are operating in a way that you would say was unscrupulous or unhealthy?
Well, the definition of a puppy mill by HSUS standards is really any breeding facility that puts money over the welfare of the dogs. Commercial breeding of dogs is really the only industry that I know of that one could really, after an initial outlay, never put in any more money into the business. So that's when we have a problem, is when dogs are just being bred continually without any veterinary care or effective food or shelter or things like that.
Can you give us an idea of what life is like for a stud, for example, in one of these breeding facilities?
Oh, sure. It's really a shop of horrors when you go. You see rows and rows and rows of wire cages, like rabbit hutches, stacked on top of one another, 10, 15, 20 cages high. So all of the animals are defecating and urinating on one another. You see a lot of open sores, rotting eyeballs, patches of mange, a breeding stud or a breeding female will be kept in a single small wire cage for their entire lives, often with several other dogs. There's no behavioral testing, so one dog may be getting picked on by several others. There's a lot of competition over food. These dogs are unsocialized, so they are terrified of humans. They'll shrink away. They won't be unaccustomed to light. Many of them are kept enclosed in barns, so actually having a bright light shined on them is terrifying. The only time that one of these dogs would be taken out is to breed, so 15 minutes every 6 months, no veterinary care, and then when they are no longer able to breed, they're put out of their misery in the most horrific ways possible.
How do these situations come to light for you? How do you hear about them?
Sure. At the Humane Society of the United States, we have a puppy mill campaign. We have a staff solely devoted to the issues of puppy mills all across the country. So we receive phone calls from across the country, generally from consumers who have purchased dogs and then found out later that those dogs had behavioral problems, they were unsocialized, they've had genetics disorders. Good, reputable breeders make sure that they follow the bloodlines and make sure that no genetic problems are present in their dogs, and also ensure that if there are problems, that the dog comes back, that the line is no longer bred. A puppy mill breeder will either be unavailable, you will not be able to find them, they will want to kill the animal, they will not want to give you your money back. So that's where we really get the bulk of our complaints.
There is actually what amounts to a puppy lemon law. What typically happens when a consumer gets a puppy that's sick or has behavior problems and they want to return the puppy or do something else to take care of the problem?
Sure. Under Pennsylvania's puppy lemon law, you do have the right to return the dog or receive your money back if the dog manifests a serious medical problem within a certain amount of time of being purchased. The problem with it is the time frame is very narrow to discover the problem, to notify the breeder of the problem if you can't get a hold of the breeder, whatever. A lot of these genetic disorders take years to manifest. And the other problem is well, getting your money back doesn't generally cover the cost of the veterinary bills, and giving the dog back after you, your family, and your children have bonded with it is incredibly heartbreaking, especially when you know that the dog is in all likelihood going to be put down. So the remedy is really insufficient under the current puppy lemon law.
What can consumers do to prevent buying puppies from puppy mills? Where's a good place to shop for and find a good puppy?
Well, I would say never, ever buy a dog from a pet store because you are not going to know for sure where that dog came from. You cannot guarantee, and the pet store cannot guarantee, that that dog didn't come from a puppy mill. We recently had an investigation into Petland, which is the largest retail chain of pet stores that sells puppies, unlike, you know, Petco and PetSmart, where we traced several dogs back to abusive puppy mills and were able to discover that despite corporate assurances from Petland in stores and on their website, that they really do not have any sort of standards program. They do not check out their breeders. They buy very often from brokers that will buy from several different breeders. So buying from a pet store means that a consumer cannot really verify that the dog did not come from a pet store. So if you are absolutely set on buying your dog and not rescuing one, then make sure you check out that breeder thoroughly. You want to find out where they're keeping their dogs. You need to see the parents of your dog. You need to verify that the dogs have adequate medical care, they are socialized, that they've interacted with humans before you take that dog home to see your family.
And reputable breeders want to see who's going to take their puppy, don't they?
Absolutely. A reputable breeder will want to ask as many questions of you as you do of them. And if you have any concerns or would like a starting point, we have a list of questions to ask your breeder on our website, www.humanesociety.org.
Are specific breeds of dogs more popular in puppy mills? You know, Paris Hilton's little dogs seem to be the rage for years, and I'm wondering if they end up in puppy mills more often than other breeds.
Absolutely. It sort of depends on the trends. Whatever is hot, whatever's selling right now, you'll see an influx of those types of dogs in these large-scale commercial breeding facilities. The flip side of that is when a particular breed of dog isn't selling, you see some of the worst abuses. Mainline Animal Rescue recently rescued an Italian greyhound mother who was being starved to death, and she was pregnant. So they actually got her into the car from the breeding facility after having to pay for her. She gave birth in the car, and of those, I believe, 7 puppies, only 4 survived because she hadn't been fed in weeks.
You know, finding these problems probably overwhelms organizations like the Humane Society of the U.S. or the ASPCA, because if hundreds of dogs end up needing a shelter, what happens in situations like that?
Well, we're really lucky that although, you know, HSUS and ASPCA are really advocating advocacy organizations. We do some sheltering, but we don't do operate shelters all over the country. So it's fantastic that we have wonderful relationships with animal sheltering organizations who are willing to work with us and open their doors to these animals. Organizations like the Harrisburg Humane Society, Mainline Animal Rescue, those types of organizations that do this every day and are pulling those dogs out constantly are really the backbone of the puppy mill rescue. And
the Amish have a tarnished reputation for their dog breeding practices. Is it justified?
I believe so. One of the reasons that Pennsylvania has such a puppy mill problem is because of our large Amish community. Raising animals is acceptable within the precepts of that religion. Also, there is a belief in the Amish community that animals do not have souls. So there really isn't any mandate that they be treated well. So it is definitely a part of the problem.
You don't publish a list of known puppy mills. Why not?
Well, the reason is because there is no legal definition of puppy mill, so actually classifying someone as such could have legal ramifications for us. What we do is compile lists of complaints against certain facilities, and then, of course, we forward those complaints and that information on to law enforcement authorities to shut down any abusive facilities.
And finally, how optimistic are you that this new law really has teeth and will begin to turn the tide here?
I'm very optimistic. It has clear, enforceable standards, doubled cage sizes, mandatory veterinary care. It'll be very easy for the dog law wardens to follow.
Sarah Speed is a lawyer and the Pennsylvania State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. She's based in Harrisburg. Thanks so much for talking with
us. Thank you.
For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia.
This program was produced in the studios of WPSU. If you have a story idea for Take Note, send it to WPSU, 120 Outreach Building, University Park, Pennsylvania, 16802, or email it to wpsu@psu.edu. This has been a presentation of Penn State Public Broadcasting.